Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast. Guess what, Keenan Laraway, Matt Maves, Cole Chaney, and Greg Woods?
What?
What's that?
We're on Stitcher. Have you heard of Stitcher?
I have.
I love Stitcher.
Yes, you do.
I logged 2,000 hours on Stitcher. It's a record.
Who keeps track of your hours on Stitcher?
Stitcher does. My brother's the only person that beat me, I think, so far.
Wow. Well, it's amazing because it has a great app for iOS and Android, which I can appreciate. And the show is streamed rather than downloaded, which is, I think it's kind of cool. No more waiting for the show you love. And if you love our show, share it from Stitcher. And most importantly, most amazingly importantly, leave us a review there. So these platforms are all about shares and reviews, and if we get some reviews, it'll put us sort of on the map over there. And if you're an iTunes user, leave us a review there too. That's kind of important. In short, we think we have a sound worth sharing. And if you feel the same, give us a review. Without you, without your shares, likes, and reviews, and tweets, and all that the happy stuff, we're just a bunch of jerks with opinions. Right?
We still are.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not much we can do about that. Yeah. So pause the show right now and go over to theshortcoat.com. Look for the Stitcher badge. Click it and leave us a quick review. But make sure you come back.
Did you do this, Dave, or did they find us?
I did it.
You did it. What started you on this path?
Actually, I ran into a PhD here at the university who has a podcast that he does in Turkish.
Wow.
So he's Turkish, and he does this podcast on, you know, sort of popular science for young people in Turkey. Turns out there's not a very big popular science press in Turkey, okay. So he's filling this need, and he wrote this, you know, book on DNA for release in Turkey, and he's gotten a heck of a lot of attention for it. And one of the things he does this podcast, and he let me know about Stitcher, and I was like, oh, okay, I could use another distribution channel. That would be pretty sweet.
Impressive.
Yes. How are you all? What did you, any, Keenan was here. I've seen Keenan this morning because he's doing CBL.
Yes.
God, you look tired, man. You all right?
What time zone am I in? What city is this?
Are you traveling right now?
It might be interview season. Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about it.
What time zone am I in?
Have you enjoyed your interviewing experience, aside from the traveling around?
Yeah, and even the traveling hasn't been too bad. I've only spent one night in O'Hare, which is, I think, actually a record for people traveling in the Midwest. So, but people have been very, very nice, all the places I've been, except one. Place will not be getting ranked. Yeah, you know. But it's been enjoyable.
What's your sort of definition of a good interview experience versus a bad interview
experience?
I
may be in the minority here, actually. There seems to be, especially in the Midwest, a trend towards really extra conversational style interviews. But I actually kind of like when they ask me about things that I took the time to put in my application. Prepared that. I'm happy to talk about it. But I think a lot of people that I've been on the trail with are saying it's a lot more, you know, what do you like to do for fun? If you were a basket of fruit, which would be the top hat? I don't know. I mean, you know.
What?
He just had a stroke.
How did you answer that?
That question was not asked of me, because I think I probably would have just cocked my head and said, uh-huh. Yeah. But no, I mean, they're asking a lot of get-to-know-you questions, and perhaps even at the expense of questions about things in your application. But I did have one negative Nancy. He read all about the teaching that I've done, and all he wanted to talk about was tell me a time when things didn't go so well. And so I told him a time that things didn't go so well, and tell me another time that things didn't go so well. And I was like, okay, here's another time that things didn't go. What about another time that things didn't go so well? You're right, actually they were all
terrible. My God, now that you mention it,
how did I
my
not
life
see
is
this before?
Awful.
Keenan, you told me earlier when you were interviewing, you were worried about breadth versus depth of experiences that you had to discuss at these interviews. Can you talk about that?
I don't even remember saying that.
So you were explaining that you were involved in a lot of things, which I think is you're everywhere, and you said you were worried about...
No, I am everywhere.
What things would they want to emphasize or...
Yeah, and that's sort of been interesting, too, and I fear being the representative M4. I think more M4 should come and be like, my interviews were nothing like this. But
that's okay.
You know, It's really been more various interviewers pick something that they're sort of entertained by, and they will ask follow-up questions. Some of them clearly have not prepared very well for the interview, so they will ask you things that are really well spelled out in your application, and so your answer ends up being refreshing what you wrote already. But some will say, I see that you gave a lecture to the IMEI class at the University of Iowa. Tell me about what that was like and what things you had to do to prepare for that or whatever. So it really just depends on the person and what their interests are.
Have I asked you on the show before, how many interviews do you want? How many interviews are you getting? Like how far are you? Because you can go on as many interviews basically as you want.
Well,
but
yeah,
as a practical matter,
in my shoes, you can. As an internal medicine candidate, I think for folks that are looking at something a little more competitive, they'll take all the ones they can get. I don't know. I'm not a big numbers guy with all of this. I think I have the backing of a pretty great medical school behind my name, and so I sort of feel like I will probably match, even if I don't rank that many schools. And I don't know if I have a number.
That's okay. Well, good. So things seem like they're going well for you despite your exhaustion.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Hey, I heard from a listener.
Oh.
I know. Brady Campbell. Brady_Campbell.
I know Brady.
Do you know Brady?
Yes.
He pointed me to a TED Talk by Dr. Leanna Wen. Her talk is about the fear that patients feel, and not just from being sick, but their fears about their doctors. Here is a clip from the talk in which her mother, who'd been diagnosed with breast cancer, discovered something disturbing about her oncologist.
She tried to look up her oncologist's phone number on the internet, and she found it. But she found something else, too. On several websites, he was listed as a highly paid speaker to a drug company, and in fact, often spoke on behalf of the same chemo regimen that he had prescribed her. She called me in a panic and I didn't know what to believe. Maybe this was the right chemo regimen for her, but maybe it wasn't.
All right, so she goes on to tell another story of a critically injured patient whose family wanted to be present for rounds, but
the head doctor, though, said no. He gave all kinds of reasons. Maybe they'll get in the nurse's way. Maybe they'll stop students from asking questions. He even said, what if they see mistakes and sue us? What I saw behind every excuse was deep fear. And what I learned was that to become a doctor, we have to put on our white coats, put up a wall, and hide behind it.
So she goes on to say that, in her opinion, fear spirals into mistrust and that it's an epidemic in medicine. So she had an idea. What if doctors became totally transparent? So she did a survey to ask people on the street what they wanted to know about their healthcare, and their answers seemed to indicate that people equate healthcare with doctors. She found that many people wanted to know that their doctors were making decisions based on science, not who pays them. I think that's pretty sure. Obvious want for a lot of people, but there was more.
Surprisingly to us, many people want to know something else about their doctors. Jonathan, a 28-year-old law student, says he wants to find someone who is comfortable with LGBTQ patients and specializes in LGBT health. Serena, a 32-year-old accountant, says that it's important to her for her doctor to share her values when it comes to reproductive choice and women's rights. Frank, a 59-year-old hardware store owner, doesn't even like going to the doctor and wants to find someone who believes in prevention first and who is comfortable with alternative treatments.
So she says the needs expressed by these people that she mentioned indicate the intimacy from the patient's perspective that the doctor-patient relationship has for them. So this kind of makes sense. If you're going to give up your secrets, who you have sex with, what drugs you take, risky behaviors, that sort of thing, these are things that you might tell your best friend, but not just anyone, right? So think about that relationship for a second from the other side. How intimate, in your experience, has it been from your direct, how intimate does the relationship between you and your patient feel when you see a patient? Keenan, you probably have more experience with this.
I think for me, probably as much as the situation dictates.
Yeah.
I can remember probably the hardest moment of my very brief training so far was a patient that I admitted to a general medicine service and then switched off the service and continued to follow on a consult service. And then later knew that this lady had gone to Comfort Cares, which is what happens when the family decides to remove aggressively trying to cure whatever the illness is. And at that point, you know, this was a challenging situation. And we had known all along that this family had not particularly cared for physicians. This is somebody who hadn't seen a doctor since her teenage years. Now she was in her mid-60s. And I think there was a general sense of mistrust towards the system. But they were trusting in, I think, the people that they had met and those that had bothered to come and sit with them and talk to them. And I don't mind telling you, I think it was hard on all of us towards the end, and we all cried after she passed away. And I think none of that was because I felt I should, or because an article in the New York Times told me I should, or even that I knew I would. It was just sort of in that moment, it was what it was. Yeah. And I wasn't...
I mean, you watched a person struggle, basically. Right. You watched, I mean...
Yeah. And I think... probably I would have to admit that I wasn't really thinking about whether it was right or wrong. It just was what it was.
So Dr. Nguyen, she feels that medicine throws up a wall. I think a lot of us have experienced this wall probably. And in this case, the wall came down for you. But she decided to advocate for sort of total transparency by doctors to their patients. And I mean total transparency. So she wants doctors to expose their values, their financial relationships, their biases, let your patients in on them. And she expected that some would be interested in doing it and others wouldn't. But she wasn't prepared for the backlash she got from doctors.
They told me that I'm a traitor to my own profession, that I should be fired, had my medical license taken away, that I should go back to my own country. My email got hacked in a discussion forum for other doctors. Someone took credit for Twitter bombing my account. Now, I didn't know if this was a good or bad thing, but then came the response. Too bad it wasn't a real bomb.
So before I let you guys have at this topic, I want to invite our listeners to weigh in too, and don't just rely on my exposition. Go look at the video. I'll post the link so you can tweet at us, email us, leave us a moment of truth on the shortcoat.com. Guys, what do you think about total transparency of the sort Dr. Nguyen proposes?
I think it's something that we've heard about, especially in our ethics class, which is something that happens in the second year. You go through that here, and it's that's always the ideal. You know, it presents you with a lot of interesting conundrums that maybe you haven't really thought about. And one of those is the interaction that you have between, for instance, drug reps, which is the case in this video of being a rep for a chemo treatment. And we're taught a lot of, you know, how much do you interact with them? How much can you accept? Do you want to accept anything? Do you want any ties with them whatsoever? And it's difficult to kind of parse that out. But on the other side of that, as a patient, if I was in this scenario and looked up my doctor, didn't have a medical background, and saw all of these things connected to this company that he was advocating that I was getting treatment with, that would be terrifying. That would probably be very, very scary. You know, what am I putting in my body here? Is it actually worth a darn, or is it just what he's getting paid for, so he's using it? It's scary. It's an interesting thought.
But she wants to go further. I mean, she wants you to tell your patients, you know,
everything.
For instance, don't believe in abortion.
Does it matter what my stance on abortion is as a future nephrologist?
Yeah, I mean, obviously depends on your.
But I mean, to her
point of view,
it sounds like it does.
I didn't really. It does sound like it does. Sounds although like, I think probably
practically, I don't know.
I
if
think
that would
practically,
come up.
I don't know how you would do it. You know, like
yeah. No, I completely agree.
You know,
but
like
I think,
how would you disclose everything about yourself to your patient? I mean, it just, you know, do you hand them a piece of paper the first time they come into your office and it lists all of your beliefs and all of your, you know, like I'm not really sure how you, but I suppose you could just pick and choose from the stuff that is relevant to your practice. I mean, that's one way to do it.
It seems really naive to the,
I can't remember. Wait, was she, what kind of doctor was she? I can't remember.
Emergency physician.
Was she emergency? Yeah. Okay.
To understand your own biases, I think that's, I think as soon as you know them, I'm not saying you treat them, but at least you're aware of them. I mean, a majority of these problems, I'm guessing, would be someone's bias that are so deeply removed from what they're aware of. Being too tired to work, maybe of things going on at home, things that like you're not acutely aware of. Like, I am pro or anti-abortion. I feel like that is a very small subset of the bias of which she speaks.
Yeah.
I also wonder if you're letting yourself in as a patient for sort of a rude awakening when you are purportedly able to hand select a physician that agrees with you, I'm making air quotes, agrees with you on everything, and then it turns out you still don't get along.
Because there's nothing screening for personality.
Right,
or, you know.
Yeah, you know, but you've found your you're pro-life, anti-physician-assisted suicide, anti-drug rep, all of these things, and you think you agree on all of these, and then you have an encounter, and things seem to go okay for a while, and then when something tough comes up, you find that it's not a person you enjoy dealing with. I
know you could take the MMPI,
yes,
and
yes.
Like distribute those.
So we could do it all by computer matching.
Yes, like I am a jerk. You know, you that, my to disclosure lonely, to you is that I'm a jerk.
Perfect. I've been looking for one of those.
So you've got farmersonly.com. Now maybe we have doctors only. I don't know.
Like doctor shopping.
Doctor
right?
shopping. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
your doctor dating profile exactly, that you hand out at the beginning of each visit. Are we compatible? Exactly.
The other thing that she got at that I don't always agree with, and she seems like a smart woman of science, is that these using an online forum, like if she actually had her medical license revoked or had barriers to job entry, that seems like a very real problem. Weird hackers online or like this tiny subset of people that are trolling on the internet, mm-hmm. We don't listen to these people. I mean, that's...
But these were doctors, she says. Yeah. These were not just people. These were not just regular internet weirdos.
They were credentialed.
Internet weirdos. Yeah.
That was what was surprising to me. Like, if that's truly the case that she got basically attacked, I mean, you would like to believe that people like yourselves would at least take a minute to go, let's think about that instead of like, you know, I want to destroy you.
You would certainly hope for a higher level of discourse, even if you sort of aggressively disagree. But
it's kind of disappointing that
it is
that would happen. I mean, I think that, I don't know, it's hopelessly naive. Is that
I think that transparency is definitely I don't understand completely the extent of what she feels as transparency, but obviously, I mean, it's important to understand when you go in someplace. If you're a consumer, you want to make sure that what you're getting is what you think you're getting, not what someone else is just going to make a bunch of money on.
What are the legitimate ramifications beyond the drug rep or relationships with big pharma? I mean, we're talking about now more about ethical or maybe pseudo-ethical stances. What are the true ramifications of that? I mean, we all say, oh, maybe there'll be some reduced access to care, but I think in the era of us being fairly aware of what's available and having the internet to tell us this is an option, it's not easy anymore for a physician to say, your options are A, B, and C, and not this mythical thing D that you've read about on the internet. That doesn't exist. I mean, I don't think you can get away with that anymore. What are the true ramifications?
She mentions about lawyers and about others having conflicts of interest that they have to disclose and things like that. So I think the issue is you're worried as a patient coming in that if your doctor feels very strongly or is being persuaded in a certain direction, that something like that will actually happen, but it won't be that obvious. That the image that a lot of people have of doctors is that they're very, you know, just objective, and that, you know, here's what they know, and, you know, they're not judging you, they're not doing anything like this, they're just presenting what they know and treating you in the best way possible. And suddenly when you get this information about potential conflicts of interest, you begin to wonder if that isn't being a little bit skewed, and that has to worry you. Are you being treated in the best way possible if this doctor is clandestinely doing something that you didn't know about?
I'm also not sure that patients want the best treatment possible, not always, necessarily. No. I think they just want somebody who's... Sometimes they want somebody who's just going to agree with them,
sure.
Which is probably not.
And I think
the best case
that
scenario.
raises the question: if Dr. Wen,
mm-hmm. yep.
if Dr. Wen's scenario comes to fruition, are we just treating patients the way they would want to treat themselves?
And then why not just say, here, yeah. You do it.
Just use WebMD. I mean,
my biases are because of my training.
Sure.
For a positive or a negative way. I mean, you know, there's... And, you know, I think maybe it's a little... It smacks a little bit of arrogance to say that any decision a doctor makes may be tainted by who is in his pocket or in his religious text. Certainly, that's a possibility. But I mm-hmm. think also, on the other side of that, when you start to question every single thing is, well, I don't like choice A, I want choice B. And because the doctor's recommending choice A, this must be a conflict of interest. I think we start to go down a road that may undermine what we're trying to do.
But I mean, even if you have those biases, if you are disclosing them, I think that's what she's getting at here. Not saying that you can't have those biases, it's that you disclose the biases, the obvious biases that you have. And then, you know, maybe that allows for conversation with the patient, or maybe they decide, you know, this isn't what I want. I'll go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it's to a certain extent, it's about comfort to begin with. You know, if I'm going to go to a mechanic, which I think we've, except for maybe Greg, because Greg is like, can fix anything, but we've all had the problem. You know, you go and you're like, what is he telling me this because I actually need to have this fixed, or is he just telling me this because he knows that I'm too stupid to know elsewhere. Yeah. So, I mean, if there's a trust going on there, maybe they won't go along with it, but maybe they'll be like, okay, well, this person has at least disclosed this. I feel comfortable with what's going on here. I know what's happening, or at least think I know what's happening, and move forward.
So let's because we can make a mess of this, let's bring vaccines.
Oh, and we have.
And let's bring vaccines.
It's what we do.
Let's bring vaccines into this.
Yeah.
Because why not? So you now have people who are pro-vaccine disclosing that that's their viewpoint on whatever their profile is or however they're being transparent, and people who are anti-vaccine saying, I'm not interested in that, without even actually having to have the conversation first. So to what end is this helpful? I mean, because I agree.
So now everybody's doing sort of echo chambering.
Does that change much, though? Because the anti-vaccine people still are probably not going to do it. So they'll go to a doctor who says, all right, good, don't do it. So then they just don't end up doing it anyway.
But I think what it changes is now we can, on every issue, you can self-select and you can say, I'm anti-vaccine, I'm pro this, I'm anti this, I'm anti beta blocker, I'm pro calcium, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I want this combination of treatment. And so
natural medicine was one that she mentioned.
Sure, natural medicine, you know, or alternative medicine.
Yeah.
And so you say, well, maybe that's good for what you want, but is that good for your health? And what does that do to outcomes? And because almost nobody is paying for their healthcare individually, what does that do to the cost in general when I just tell anyone, you can have whatever doctor you want that prescribes whatever you want, and you're allowed to ask them up front, will you give me what I want? What does that do to the rest of us?
True.
It is a huge, opening a huge can of worms that I'm not sure, you know, once they're open, whether they would ever, whether it would be useful or.
I would be interested to know how broad that viewpoint of those angry doctors is, because I assume for her to be feeling like she does and doing a TED talk about it, it was pretty widespread. But I'd be interested to get some numbers to see just how many doctors do feel that way all across the board.
Well, she would argue that it's that the response that both patients and doctors have this fear of each other. And so that's not good for the therapeutic relationship anyway. So, I don't know. All right. Well, we'll be back in just a second.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Intern. We're back. I just want to point out that we are still looking for an intern for the show. UI Pre-Med would be lovely to come and work with us on it. So look for that info at hireahawk.com. And this isn't just any internship, Cole.
This is the internship. Inaugural.
We're looking for a little help with the show, yes. But I also want whoever we bring on to get a glimpse of the possibilities that social media and podcasts can offer them as physicians, because I kind of feel strongly that it's a way to get in touch with your patients, with your fellow doctors, with students, all that kind of stuff. We're going to shut down the application process soon, though. So do visit hireahawk.com and apply. And I promise you that you'll get something out of it, and that we will gain the ability to release shows on the day that it is recorded.
Yet no more evergreen stories.
That's right, which means we'll be... Because that's all our stories are evergreen.
They're forever green.
And which means we'll be current and up-to-date rather than a week behind. So I'm looking forward to it, and I think it'll be cool.
Come meander on the margins of medicine with us.
Oh, man.
That was good.
I should have used that.
It's my tattoo, so...
Any news stories that you people want to share?
I have one that.
Thank you for raising your hand.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for saying that.
You I raised in the my back?
Yes, yeah, me. Okay. Oh, me? Okay, thank you. A little bit of a background. In college, I got my degree in neuroscience, so that is a field that has always fascinated me. And this week, I read about a story, a kind of a sad story, really, of a woman over in the UK And this will be maybe humorous on the front, but she has said it really has ruined her life. This is a woman who several months ago had a procedure to try to fix this, and it didn't work. So now she's worried that she will forever be stuck with this syndrome, where every time she hears a song by the artist Neo, she has a seizure. And this has been going on for a long time.
Wow.
Any song by Neo, especially the popular ones, because they're played absolutely everywhere, she goes into these epileptic fits. She vomits. She has a seizure. She can't go to work. She can't go through malls or to disco clubs or anything like that. She can't go anywhere because they play these popular songs by Neo, and she has a seizure. So she went into a doctor back in June to have a procedure where they actually removed most of her left temporal lobe to try to fix this. And it helped a little bit with the epileptic seizures, but she still has symptoms that are triggered by Neo songs, and now she's worried that there is no cure in sight. So she has to, whenever she goes somewhere where there's live music being played or wedding receptions, things like that, she has to go up front and tell them, you can't play Neo because I will have a seizure.
I can imagine that conversation goes very well.
She said it really doesn't.
Yeah.
I think, Dave, what you're about to do is going to get us sued here. So
no, I'm going to. I think this falls within fair use. So I don't. I'm not going to play the whole thing. But I have no idea what you're talking about when you say Neo. I've just picked one at random.
He did a song. Well, he's done several. One of them's with Pitbull, and I don't really know his song, so I can't tell you if this is a good one or not.
I don't think you spelt it right.
It's N-E-Y-O.
Oh, well then that's
otherwise you're, yeah.
Well, Dave looks for it. So
yes.
I can't stop it. I can't stop. Oh, there we go.
So that seems artist-specific is a very odd thing.
It is.
And have you ever studied, neuroscience.
So there was a woman that's had this happen to her before, and her procedure actually seemed to fix it. But other than that, there really haven't been instances of this before, no.
And I always think when seizure, you think...
is that Neo with a space? Neo?
N-E-Y-O.
Oh.
You think of the Pokemon with the flashing lights. That's sort of the trigger that I think of.
My Electric Soldier Porygon was that episode, I believe. Sorry, I do know that.
Wow.
One.
Wow.
Sorry. Take that out.
Sorry again.
We'll delete that one. But that's, I think, more traditionally the flashing light seizure-inducing as opposed to rhythmic
This is
sound.
Called musicogenic.
Musicogenic.
Would be the word you're looking for. Yes. So this is very unusual, and it's doubly bad because it's a popular artist who is very current. It'd be fine if it was some obscure, indie artist or dream
you
pop
too.
Or whatever. That'd be bad.
It's a callback.
but it isn't. It's something that you can be walking through a store or a restaurant and likely hear it on the radio.
Okay, I need to play this clip just because I've searched hard for it. All right, I think we get the idea. I really don't want to be sued.
Yeah.
But I just had a seizure.
That was an example. The other woman, by the way, I just remembered, her affliction was with Sean Paul music. Dead serious.
These are like R&B hip hop.
Yeah. So it's just something about the tone.
Is it auto-tune? Let's get to this.
Oh,
whoa.
That could be it. Yes.
I think a little bit of auto-tune's causing
Not that we're accusing anybody of using auto-tune because we know that ever happens.
No.
But
this is interesting.
Certainly not Neo.
Sort of robotic noise.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's...
It is intriguing.
That is fascinating.
I hope that she figures it out. I hope somebody can help her, or that Neo's career kind of tapers off soon, but...
whichever comes first.
Yeah. Whichever comes first.
Okay. I mean, everybody's musical career eventually tapers off.
It's an odd thought. I was thinking about that the other week, yes.
I guess...
Everybody has a last hit.
There is an end in sight. She just doesn't know when. Wow.
Yep.
Okay. Hey, last Friday when we were recording the show, I didn't realize this at the time. Otherwise, I would have wished you all a happy World Vasectomy Day.
Ooh.
Oh, boy.
Yes, World Vasectomy Day was November 7th. And lots of things are live streamed these days. The launch of a new Apple device, sporting events. And in June of this year, a house that was teetering on the edge of a cliff in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and about to be intentionally set on fire. These are things that have been streamed. But on November 7th, filmmaker Jonathan Stack and Dr. Doug Stein live streamed 28 vasectomies from the Planned Parenthood headquarters in Kissimmee, Florida, to celebrate the second annual World Vasectomy Day.
My understanding is vasectomies are reversible, correct?
Depends on how you do it.
Depends.
Explain so, like, the... so if you go in there with, I don't know, dynamite, no.
a friend of mine, his father has had it done several times, and it really hasn't worked. So it can fail, and I don't know how that's possible, but he's been telling me that for years. There's several different ways to
he's
do
got
it.
Got some strong swimmers.
there's the classic way, which is pretty not reversible, but I don't fully understand the other procedure, but there's almost like a gel or resin that is put in there that can be dissolved.
Yeah,
at a later
so they
point.
used to just clip them,
right? Yeah,
and that would be of course,
yes, and that
difficult
that
to
is still reversible, but it's difficult because you can try to sew everything back together, but obviously if you wait long enough, there's scar tissue and there's a lot of things to deal with.
The event is intended to send a strong message about family planning, parenthood, gender equality. While supporting an informed choice, vasectomy is one of the safest forms of birth control, they want you to know, and has an error rate of -1%, or of about 1%.
Minus 1%.
Whoa.
It takes babies out of the world.
That would explain the anti-vasectomy lobby.
It's a child.
We are the -1%.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, vasectomies are less common than tubal ligation. Six times more tubal ligations are performed than vasectomies. So,
Dave, are you vasectomized?
It's a little,
whoa,
a little personal.
You don't have to answer.
I don't. So yeah. So yeah, it's too bad we didn't. We could have played some live vasectomy. I'm sure they would have been very, very exciting. Okay. University of Washington researchers, again, for the second time, have demonstrated direct brain-to-brain interfaces between people.
Yes, P.
Go on.
Yeah, so in August of 2013, a University of Washington team showed two people using this brain-to-brain interface to send a command from one person to move the hand of a second person. So the setup is this. The first person wears an EEG cap. They call it a transcranial magnetic stimulation coil, which actually looks a bit like a large, you've seen these, lamps with the lenses in them that you can use to like look at things very close. Well, it looks sort of like that. It's like a ring, that sort of sits near your head. And, they place that over the bit of the brain that controls movement of the right hand. And apparently they can send, one person can send that command to another. And of course that needed to be replicated. So this year they did that. They replicated it using three pairs of people, which the article I read describes as walk-ins. So no training apparently needs to be, I don't know. I think that's what they're trying to get at, that no training is needed. They weren't just like, ding dong, I'm here to. So they wanted to demonstrate that anyone can do this. So here's the experimental setup. The sender is looking at a video game that they can't interact with. The receiver can't see the game, but can interact with the game via a touchpad. So if it worked, the receiver's hand would twitch, if the sender commanded it, firing an in-game cannon to defend a city.
Cool.
Accuracy ranged from 25 to 83%. I don't know if such a wide range of accuracy
is
a good thing. But anyway, they could determine interestingly, the researchers could determine the exact amount of info sent from the sender to the receiver. I don't know how useful that is either, but it's kind of interesting, like to think that there's an amount of info. I guess that makes total sense, but.
I always think about the past when our medical school, so doctors we work with today do not have laptops or computers. And so, you know, if they wondered something, there's an extra calorie burnt for every single fact that you need to look up. You got to dig through the book. You got to go to the library, right? There's just an extra amount of workload. Okay.
I'm looking forward to where the calories come in.
These brain things. I see the day when I'm explaining to, you know, my grandkids that, you know, we couldn't just download the information into our brains. Like, I had to work for hours, and it wouldn't stick even post-exam. I mean, doesn't this takes us...
There is an interest. I remember a movie from 1983. I looked it up. Starring Christopher Walken and Natalie Wood.
It's the second time you said Walken. It's really weird.
Oh, what?
Isn't that weird?
Starring Natalie Wood?
Christopher Walken and Natalie Wood. It was her last movie before she died. Cliff Robertson was also in the movie. And it's called Brainstorm. Go and look it up. I think it actually holds up kind of well, but the idea is that these scientists created a device that would allow you to record the thoughts or the experiences of other people. And it's kind of a good sci-fi movie for 1983. I don't know.
How's it compete against Soylent Green?
I did not.
it was a horrible sci-fi movie.
Not a fan of that one, really.
I hated Soylent Green.
It's like classically bad.
It's not called Soylent Green.
Yeah, it is.
It is. Okay.
Yeah. I think the books may be named differently. Should we ruin it for everybody?
It's made of people.
I kind of did, but. Sorry.
Anyway, this also has really cool implications for prosthetics, I think. That's sort of the other application of this that makes the most sense, right?
Although I don't know why you need to remotely control your prosthetic. I guess it would be kind of cool if you were in bed and your prosthetic was, you know, on the... And you needed to, like, check your phone.
It can still be attached to you when you're doing this, because then all you need to do is think about moving your arm and your prosthetic will move.
Yeah.
So...
Which they already... I mean, they kind of do already, but it's a little bit different.
Kind of amazing. Google has a new perk. So a new perk for employees. So we were talking episode 50, we talked about Facebook and Apple's programs to allow employees to have their eggs or their spouse's eggs frozen as a way to retain talented young female employees. The idea is that it gives them increased options to delay pregnancy. And so they'll just keep working. They'll keep slaving away at the computer. So now Google has promised employees that if they or their parents if they or their family members get cancer, they will pay for DNA testing to discover what meds will work best for treatment. These are very high tech tests. They cost between, according to this article I read, in the Daily Mail, about $5,800 to $7,200. And they'll start this on January 1st. Of this year. Again, the goal, it seems to me, is to foster company loyalty to retain the best staff.
Live longer and work for us longer.
Yeah.
I guess it's unclear to me, though, whether this is going to help Google retain anybody. Because people are very bad at estimating risk, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a hard time believing that people will say, you know what, I might get cancer someday. So I should stick around just in case I do, so that I can take advantage of this program. I mean, I guess if I got cancer while I was working at Google and I was cured, that would probably make me feel increased loyalty. Like, thank God. But, it just doesn't seem to me to be like the best possible perk.
How much of this also is an image thing as well, to try to, as a marketing ploy, say, look at how much we take care of our employees?
This is also, I mean, the big economic thing here is that when you factor in tax rates and also changing health insurance laws, which are generally insurance getting more expensive, companies need other ways to pay employees, right, that don't involve a 35 to 40% tax rate. So these perks, for example, you actually can maybe get more bang for your buck and pay the employee less is the sort of motivation. You know, it's back in, I think, what was it, World War II, when... You know, all these insurance policies were enacted because there was a price freeze on wages. I mean, I think a lot of these, as an employee, I would first be like, this is awesome. And then my second thing would be like, well, maybe I could just take home some of that salary, you know, with all these awesome egg programs and awesome. So that's always.
I'm impressed that you brought in World War II history to our podcast today. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know any. That's it.
Did you just make that up?
Yeah, all of it.
Oh, my God.
I blacked out. What? No, that's, I mean, that's like pretty common. I was a finance undergrad, so I had to learn a little bit about this.
I just think it, you know, like from Google's standpoint, here's another thing that they might want to consider. The ethics here are a problem. The healthcare costs of those who've had cancer are probably greater than those who haven't had cancer, right? So they may end up retaining more expensive employees, in the end, because, you know, the people who have cancer, they're like, I'm going to stay at Google because I love Google. And, I guess though they might be good at estimating risks, which would be nice.
This is like the interesting studies when the smoking, with the thought was, you know, if we can rid society of smoking, we can save these billions of dollars or trillions of dollars of healthcare costs. And then all of a sudden, I think it was Sweden or Finland, basically had figured out that, well, actually smoking kills people when they're somewhat young, and we don't get a lot of these long-term health chronic conditions of 60, 70, 80-year-olds. And it oddly backfired in a weird way. So this seems like something else that sort of it's a perk, but it also could weirdly, like you said, end up being like Google be filled with these people that maybe have these chronic health conditions.
Note that the Carver College of Medicine is not endorsing smoking in any way, shape, or form.
No, I mean, that's why it was a controversial study, right?
No,
that's the problem.
And I mean, a lot of this is the arguments for other public health interventions are based on this as well.
Yeah.
Trying to predict which substances will get us towards the later end of life.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know about this Google egg thing, but...
they should call it that.
Google egg. Google egg thing.
Right before Apple comes in with the iEgg.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you, guys.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for acknowledging my thank you. Appreciate that. Thanks for listening to the Short Code Podcast. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, like Mr. Campbell did, that would be great. Go to theshortcoat.com and leave us a message. Do follow us and talk to us on Twitter so that you can stay up to date on what's happening at the Margins of Medicine. The show is made possible by the strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine, Student Government, and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producers are Dave Etler and Jason Lewis. Our opening theme music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by C2C. We'll talk to you in 1 week.